Derwin hiked his robe over his knees and waded into the reed-fringed pool. The afternoon sun fell in slanting shafts through broad oaks and silver-leaved birch to glint in shimmering bands upon the clear water. Tiny fish flashed away from Derwin's intruding feet. He stepped carefully into deeper water, scanning the pebble-strewn bottom as he splashed along. He thought for a moment to throw off his robe and submerge himself in the pool's cool depths, as was his custom on a warm summer's afternoon in Pelgrim Forest. But he thought better of the notion, inviting though it was, and continued his browsing. He soon had reason to be glad he had kept his robe, for as he worked his way around the pool, dipping now and then into the water, he noticed something white shining in the water. He glanced again and realized that it was a reflection on the mirrored surface of the pool. Derwin looked up and saw a woman clothed all in white standing on the shaggy, grass-covered bank above him.
My lady, you gave me a jump. I did not know that I was being watched.
I'm sorry, Derwin. I did not mean to alarm you. You appeared so deeply engrossed, I feared to disturb your thought. Forgive me.
Your consideration is most thoughtful, but unnecessary. I am only gathering some biddleweed for a Tishane.
Water hemlock? That is a deadly poison, is it not?
You know the plants of the field and the forest?
Only a few. My mother, Queen Eleanor, knew many remedies and made our medicines for us. As a child, I helped to gather the herbs.
Well, then you know that a plant is neither deadly nor dangerous, but the intent of the healer makes it so. Yes, some are very powerful, but in wise hands, even the most poisonous may make a wonderfully potent cure.
Your hands are surely the wisest in the realm, kind hermit. Your medicines are most efficacious.
Oh, my lady, you do not know how sorry your words make me.
Have I said something wrong? Please tell me.
The queen drew a few steps closer to the edge of the bank. Derwin waded toward her.
No, you intended nothing wrong. But your words mock my lack of skill. For the one patient I would above all heal with my humble craft lies abed no better now than when I first began his treatment. His malady resists my utmost art.
Surely it is a most subtle malady.
So it is.
Derwin peered into Alenia's deep green eyes and read the heavy burden of care which grew there. Every day added to the weight. He felt powerless to help her, as he felt powerless when he stood over the birth of a peasant baby born too soon and dying before it had begun to live. He would have taken the burden upon himself, though it was 1,000 times greater. But there was nothing he could do save stand aside, humbled by his own uselessness.
Do you think the Most High God hears our prayers for the sick?
He must, my lady. He hears all prayers and answers each in its own season.
Then prayer will do what potions cannot.
You shame me with your faith. In my search through all my medicines, I have sorely neglected that remedy. But no more.
The queen raised her eyes to a sky shining soft and blue and bright in the afternoon light. Clouds fair and far away drifted slowly on the breeze which rustled the trees gently from time to time. The little pond was a polished glass reflecting all that passed above. Alenia plucked a tiny purple flower from a cluster at her feet. She gazed into it, as if seeking a sign from its maker. Derwin continued wading, stooping now and then to snatch up a plant by its roots. When he had collected enough, he strode through the water and climbed the bank where Alenia had settled to wait in the shade.
What is happening, Derwin? It seems to me that something very bad, some dark evil is growing, drawing nearer. Sometimes I stop for no reason, and a cold fear passes over me. It is gone again as quickly as it came, but afterwards it lingers in the air like a chill. And nothing is the same.
I too have felt it, but I am at a loss to explain it. Something, I believe, is moving in the land. Something evil, yes. It is unknown now, but will not remain so. Too soon we will know what it is.
To hear you speak so does cheer me, though your words are not happy ones. At least I know that a dear friend feels as I do and understands.
I would reassure you if I could.
You have done your service well. I came here hoping to find you and to rest a little. I have seen naught of the hills and woods of late, and the summer is waxing full.
It is peaceful here. When I come here, I can almost imagine that I am in the heart of Peldrin itself. It is so quiet. I take heart that even in a storm-blown sea of troubles, there are still islands of serenity to be found. Nothing can touch them, and nothing will.
The queen moved to rise, and Derwin offered his hand.
Stay a while longer if you wish, my lady. I must go and begin with these.
Derwin shook sparkling drops from the bittleweed.
No, we will return together. I must look in on the king once again.
They moved to their horses and the ride back to Ascalon Castle in the quiet warmth of each other's company.
Where do you come from, changeling?
Quentin was squeezing the water from his jerkin.
And what is your name?
I'll not tell you until I know who it is that asks.
All right, a name for a name. I am Quentin, and this is my friend and servant, Toli.
As he said their names, Quentin thought he saw a flicker of recognition cross the girl's comely features.
Do those names mean anything to you?
No. Should they?
There are some who would have heard them spoken before. That is all.
I suppose there are some who have heard of most anyone as loud and quarrelsome as you two are.
You have not told us your name, though we have given ours.
I give my name to whom I choose, and I choose to be known only by my friends.
If you knew who it was that spoke to you...
If you knew who it was who you mistreated...
The girl turned on Quentin again. Toli caught her by the arms once more.
Peace! What my master is trying to tell you, my lady, is that we are sworn to protect all subjects of the realm. We are at your service.
Toli released her when she grew quieter.
Well, you need have no care for me. I am not one of your king's subjects.
Not of Mensendor. Ah, now we are getting somewhere.
The girl looked at each of them from beneath dark lashes.
Very well. I will trust you, but only because your servant has a mannered tongue. I am Esme. My home is in Elsendor.
Then you are very far from home. What brings you to Mensendor and to this modest village yonder?
The village was not my destination, I assure you, sir. But my tale is not for your ears, worry me though you will.
And who might best hear your tale, if not king's men?
The king himself.
Then allow me to offer you the king's protection until you shall obtain audience with him.
Esme smiled triumphantly and nodded. Quentin looked heavenward, as if seeking patience.
I accept your protection. It seems a woman needs it in this rough land. Then take me at once to the king, I charge you.
Toli is right to offer you the king's protection, and we will ride to the king. But not yet. We have a charge placed upon us by the king himself and cannot return until it is accomplished.
The young lady frowned and seemed about to lash out angrily once more, but again Toli interceded.
My master speaks the truth. Were it not for the urgency of our errand, we would gladly conduct you directly to the castle itself. We return there ourselves as soon as may be.
Then I will go myself. With or without your protection, my mission must not wait.
How will you go? In your boat? That would take far longer than you might think. The current of the Hurweed is strong. Going against it is not easily done. And Ascalon is far. Or perhaps you would walk all the way?
Or you could give me your horse.
My master is suggesting prudence, my lady. Our errand is perhaps of an end not many days hence. We have good horses and can reach Ascalon swiftly at need. Come with us, for your protection, and so you may reach the king the sooner.
The fiery young lady stared from one to the other of them before she made up her mind.
Very well, I will go with you. There seems no better choice.
With that, Esme turned and began walking back toward the abandoned village of Persh. Toli and Quentin followed behind, and upon reaching the village square, Esme turned to them.
I will attend directly.
She disappeared into one of the dwellings.
I will wait here for our proud companion. Fetch the horses and we'll away as soon as she returns.
Toli brought the horses and set himself to redistributing small items of their traveling effects.
What are you doing?
I assume that you would not care to have the ladies share your mount, so I'm making ready mine.
I will take the responsibility. It is my place.
How so? I am your servant. It is my place. And it is my tongue which placed this burden upon your back. Therefore, I will bear it.
If it pleases you, Toli, you shall carry her in your arms all the way. Have it as you will.
I am ready.
The pair turned to see a very different young woman than the one they had fished from the sea. She had gathered back her hair and bound it in a leather thong. She wore riding trousers, but of a finer cut and fit than a man's, and embroidered with intricate designs along the seams. She wore a short cloak thrown over one shoulder. It, too, was carefully embroidered and matched her trousers. The cloak was of a deep blue, as was the soft, short tunic under it. A thin belt of new leather held a long dagger at her waist. Soft leather boots covered her feet and reached almost to her knees. A more remarkable transformation could hardly have been anticipated. Tully and Quentin blinked in wonder. Esme looked like a warrior princess, but such things were unheard of in Mensendor.
Which horse will I have?
Tully has agreed to share his with you.
Without another word, they climbed into their saddles. They soon left the silent village behind. As the declining sun lengthened their shadows upon the green hills, they stopped for the night in a stand of thin aspens near a brook. Quentin and Tully routinely began making camp, while Esme planted herself on a grassy knob and drew her knees up to wait. Only when Tully had meat on the spit and broth bubbling in the shallow pot did she approach.
We will eat better tomorrow, perhaps. We did not have the opportunity to gather provisions as we would have liked.
It appears a banquet to me. I have not eaten in 2 days.
The confession shamed Quentin, who colored deeply.
I must apologize for my behavior back there, m'lady. It was not meet of me to judge you so.
And I have misjudged you. But perhaps you will grant me my error. A woman must sometimes discourage untoward advances by strange men. I thought you would take advantage of me.
I would pity the man who tried.
No harm will come to you while you remain with us, m'lady.
I thank you, good sir.
When their eyes met, Tully looked away quickly and finished preparing the meal. When it was ready, they sat down together. Tully handed a plate of meat around and filled their bowls with broth. He broke some crusts of hard bread, which they each dipped into the broth to soften it for chewing. Esme ate with a most unladylike appetite, which Quentin and Tully made certain not to notice.
You are most kind not to scold my ill manners. The food does so warm an empty stomach.
How could we scold what we ourselves indulge? Have more. You are welcome.
I have eaten quite enough, thank you. Tully, your way with simple fare is praiseworthy. I would care to see what you could do with more exotic victuals.
Tully said nothing, but merely smiled mysteriously.
Would you now tell us what you were doing in the village alone?
Esme looked into her bowl of broth, as if the answer might be read there. She cocked her head to one side.
That I was alone was no fault of my own. I went there, as you would surmise, to obtain the clothes you first saw me wearing. I found the village empty, as you did, so I helped myself to the garments.
You wished to disguise yourself? Why?
I have already told you a woman cannot be too careful traveling alone. It was a poor disguise, I know. But I thought it might serve until I could discover another, or until... Disguises were no longer necessary.
Do you know so little of Mensendor, then, that you think every man a rogue?
It is not Mensendor subjects that I fear, though I did not propose to put them to the test. But tell me of your errand. Something tells me that we may be of closer purpose than seems first apparent.
We go to see comrades long overdue. They were sent to...
To derive the truth from certain rumors now growing in the land.
They rode to the south, your friends?
Yes, south along the coast.
Good sirs, I greatly fear for your friends. I do not wonder that they are long overdue or that they may not return at all.
Quentin leaned forward in keen attention. Tully laid aside the utensils and watched Esme carefully.
What do you know about this?
Only this. It was between Dom and Persh that I lost my companions 2 days ago.
There you are.
Quentin moved quietly up to stand at Tully's shoulder.
I should have known you'd be stargazing.
I could not sleep, Kenta. The star is growing.
It looks the same to me. It will be dawn soon. Perhaps we should make ready to leave. Our new companion's words have troubled me. It would ease my mind to be on our way. I would not like to think that Thedo and Ronsard were trapped because we didn't warn them and prevent it.
Yes, the star grows each night, and evil increases.
Tully turned and looked at Quentin, his large dark eyes filled with a light that Quentin had rarely seen.
I will make ready the horses and wake the lady. I fear the day is already far spent.
He slipped away to leave Quentin pondering his words and peering up at the star glowing brightly in the east. Quentin heard a soft tread behind him, light as a shadow, and Esme came to stand beside him.
So you know about the star, too?
We have been watching it, yes. Though what it betokens is not certain.
There is no need to spare me your worst suspicions. Our priests are well acquainted with heavenly signs and the reading of portents. I know what they say about the praying star. But I am not afraid.
Then you are braver than I, m'lady. For I must admit that I sometimes feel very much afraid when I look upon it.
Tolly brought the horses, and the three mounted up. They left the shelter of the aspen grove, slipped out into the waning night, and moved across the starlit hills. Behind them rose the cragged wall of the Fiskills and the narrow trail beside the sea. They had come through that pinched corridor late in the afternoon and pushed on into the sloping foothills on the other side to find their camp for the night. Although extremely curious about his new charge, Quentin had not pressed her for details of her story. She did not seem inclined to talk about the loss of her other companions, nor about the mission which took her to King Escobar. But her fearful thoughts on the safety of Thedo and Ronsard had unsettled him, for he had been feeling a vague uneasiness regarding them himself. She had put words to his doubt, and had made it real and urgent.
They must have gone southward toward Halidom.
Quentin had spoken as they sat around the campfire after their supper.
Otherwise Esme and her party would have met them on the road between Dom and Persh.
But why would they go so far?
I will ask them when we next meet. Perhaps they saw something which took them there. These empty villages are mystery enough for me.
They had lapsed into silence and uneasy rest. Quentin's restive mind gnawed at his unanswered questions, like a hound with a twice-picked shank. He felt better now that they were moving again. Soon the horizon would begin to lighten in the east, as the sun rolled back the darkness for another day. But now they rode as night's children, slipping unseen through the sleeping world. Quentin struck once more along the coastal road, a wide rock-strewn path which linked the seaside villages. If Ronsard and his knights were to be found, it would likely be along this road, although there were other, more infrequently traveled routes to the north through the brown wilderlands. These were the tracks which the traders used to traverse the vast and empty Southlands and bring them to the more populated regions of the north. The empty villages, first Persh, then Yallow and Biscan, had greatly troubled him. Though he sought time and again for a logical explanation, none was forthcoming. He wondered if Thedo and Ronsard had discovered them as well. They must have if they had passed through, or the towns may have been abandoned after the knights had ridden on. There was no telling how long ago they had traveled the road, where they might have stayed, or who they might have seen. Quentin hoped, though reason told him six armed knights were a match for anything, that they had not encountered whatever it was that had overtaken Esme's party. They rode for an hour or more, following the rising and falling trail as it climbed and descended the gently undulating hills along the coast. At each crest they could see the great sea, lying dark and still in the distance. Gerfallon was not troubled by the mere vexations of mortal men. He slept in his deep bed, and his creatures with him. Quentin stopped at the crest of the next hill and waited until Tolly had drawn up beside him, with Esme sitting behind him, her hands on her knees.
What do you think that could be?
Quentin nodded in the direction of the dark northern hills. A faint leaden smudge could be barely seen, glowing in the sky far away.
If I did not know better, I would say the sun is coming up in the north today. A false sun, that would be.
I have seen such false sunrises, and you may suspect some misfortune is at hand.
What is it?
Fire.
Are you certain? It does not look like fire to me. Why, it would take a pile of wood the size of a
village.
You do not think Yulam lies in that direction?
Yes, a league to the north, I would say.
Then we waste time talking. We may be of some help. Let us go.
Hold tight, my lady.
As the horses galloped at full speed, the glow on the horizon brightened and spread. At half a league, it covered the far hills and deepened with an ugly reddish hue. The hanging gloom of smoke could be discerned against the darker curtain of night. Quentin reined to a halt at the bottom of a deep ravine.
I think Yulam lies just beyond the ridge.
The ravine carved its way through a long trough of a valley, bounded on three sides by low ridges. From the bottom of the dry stream bed, the sky to the north shone as rust, and the smoke rolled away on the landward wind.
Something is wrong. We should proceed with caution until we can find out where the enemy lies.
I agree. We are only three against who knows how many.
Quentin looked at her with surprise. She evidently counted herself as one of the protectors, rather than the one protected.
Why must there be an enemy? Surely you don't think...
Quentin stopped. He knew Tolly's uncanny instinct well enough to know, but even his slightest whim should be taken seriously.
Very well. We will continue along the valley until we draw even with the town. Then we can climb out below it in the shelter of the ridge.
They started off again, but at a more measured gait. Quentin led the way, scanning the tops of the hills for any signs of unusual activity. They had proceeded only a little way when the course wound around a sharp bend.
Wait! Listen!
Hold! Hold! In the name of the Dragon King!
The people eventually stopped. The sight of the instantly appearing horse and rider rooted them to the spot. For a moment, no one dared to move. Quentin judged them to be as many as 50 in all, men, women, and children. One brave man stepped forward.
Do not hinder us, sir. Whoever you be, if you be friend, let us go.
The man approached Quentin slowly. The others behind him were too frightened to move.
We will do you no harm. Have no fear.
The destroyer is upon us. We have only escaped with our lives. Let us go. Even now he comes for us.
Who is this destroyer? We will meet him.
No, it is too late.
The man made a quick motion to his followers, and as they started to move on, he suddenly threw his hand in the air.
They have found us!
Quentin looked behind the man and saw something moving by torchlight down the sides of the ravine. He drew his sword from its place behind his saddle and heard the ring of Tolly's blade at the same time.
Run for it! We will protect your escape!
Tolly charged ahead, and Quentin saw more torches boiling down the side of the ravine. He leaned forward on Blazer's neck, darted toward the embankment, and drove straight to the nearest of them. He heard Tolly's blade sing in the air. With his own sword held high, Quentin leapt across the flat bed of the stream and caught a confused group of mail-clad soldiers as they tumbled down the bank. Two of them felt the bite of his blade, and two others fled back up the bank. Turning, Quentin found his way barred from behind. Quentin's sword became a flashing shield before him as he fought to Tolly's side. It was clear that the soldiers had not anticipated finding men on horseback. They were uncertain what to do and ran into each other in an effort to stay out of range of Tolly's well-trained steeds. This led Quentin to believe that, though greatly outnumbered, they would prevail. But once over the initial surprise, the soldiers quickly regrouped and surrounded the riders.
We are cut off! We must break through the line! Where is the weakest point?
There! See that gap!
Good eye, girl! Follow me!
Quentin threw the reins ahead, and Blazer sprang for the spot. Closer, he saw that a wall of low bushes stood in the gap. Before he had time to think, Blazer was up and over it. Tolly was not so lucky. Riv, with the weight of an extra rider, charged up and cleared the shrubs with his forelegs, but his hind legs became tangled in the branches. Quentin saw all three go down as soldiers instantly converged on the spot. Blazer thundered to a churning stop, and Quentin pulled him around and headed back into the fray. Quentin saw Riv thrashing his head as the horse regained his feet. Tolly and Esme were lost beneath a dozen black shapes of soldiers swarming over them. Quentin bore down and slashed out at the jumble of lances and swords. He thrust and thrust again, and the roiling mass of bodies parted. Then he felt something tugging at his cloak, yanking him backwards. Hands reached out and grabbed his arms. His sword was struck from his hand. Blazer reared and jumped, but the grip on Quentin's arms held firm, and he was hauled from his saddle. As he tumbled to the ground, he saw Esme leap up out of nowhere and dart past him. For one heartbeat, their eyes met. In that same instant, Quentin thought she would come to his aid, but she turned away and was instantly in Tolly's saddle. Then, Quentin was on the ground, and a foot smashed into his throat. As the world spun sickeningly before his eyes, he heard the sound of Riv's hooves pounding away. Heavy draperies were hung across the windows of the Dragon King's chamber. The barest thread of light shone through a chink in the gathered cloth to fall in a single shaft upon the king's high bed. Otherwise, the room was as dark as a cave deep under a hill. Derwin entered quietly and stood for a moment by the door. He pressed a finger to his chin and then moved closer. He stepped near the stricken king and stooped to peer into the sleeping man's face. It was then that he detected the faint, putrid odor of death. The holy man spun around and lay the wooden goblet he carried on a nearby table. He went to the high, narrow window and seized the draperies in both hands and pulled with all of his might. Fresh air swept fair and warm into the night-chilled room and banished the foul stench.
My king, awaken! Do you hear me? Awaken, I say, and throw off the sleep of death!
Derwin snatched up the goblet and, slipping his arm beneath Escobar's head, brought it close to the invalid's lips. He poured, and the yellow liquid ran down the king's chin and neck, staining his bedclothes. In a moment, the gray eyelids flickered and raised, revealing two dark eyes, filmy with stupor.
Awake, Escobar! Your time is not yet!
The eyes stared unmoving in their milky gaze.
Oh, have I come too late?
What is it, Derwin? What has happened?
The queen appeared in the open doorway. She took two steps into the room, then saw her husband staring upward, motionless.
He is with us still, my lady, but for how long I cannot say.
Alenia clutched Derwin's arm for support, then threw herself upon the bed, burying her face deep in the bedclothes. Derwin stood aside, regarding the queen and her dying king. His own heart swelled with pity and grief.
O God Most High, you give men life and receive it back from them when their span is done. All things grow in their season as established by your command. Surely it is to you a hateful thing when life is cut short. An evil malady afflicts our king and crushes him in a deadly embrace. Release him from it. Turn his steps back from their downward path and restore him once more to his loved ones and to his realm.
Derwin's quiet prayer lingered in the air like a healing balm. The breeze blew softly, carrying the scent of roses from the gardens outside.
Derwin, look!
In her hands, Alenia clasped one of Escobar's as she knelt at his side. The king was now gazing quietly at both of them. His eyes were moist with tears.
Oswald, fetch me the flagon upon my work table!
The worried servant disappeared at once and returned with the utmost haste. Derwin once more administered the liquid.
Have I fallen so low as to be poisoned in my own bed?
The king complains. That is certainly a good sign.
The queen turned an anxious visage toward the hermit.
My lady, he is safe for the moment, but not out of danger yet.
Derwin moved about the bed and began throwing off the coverings of wool and fur.
I have been foolish and slow-witted, however. Perhaps the king would not have sunk so far, almost beyond return, if I had been more observant. Come, my lady. We must get him up.
Do you think?
At once! He must save the strength he still possesses. He must use it to gain more. Help me get him on his feet.
They took between them the unresisting body of the king, now light as feather down, and raised it carefully. Supporting him by the arms, they pulled him from the bed gently and placed his bare feet upon the floor. The queen threw a worried glance at Derwin.
Continue! It must be done!
Carefully, they walked him step by halting step back and forth across the room, stopping to stand before the window each time to allow him to catch his breath. On and on they walked, the king's head lolling on his shoulders, barely conscious. By midday, Escobar could move freely, though he still required the arm of his queen for support. His brow was damp with sweat. He swooned with exhaustion. Derwin and Oswald carried him back to the bed as Alenia looked on, wringing her hands.
He will sleep soundly now, I think. We will wake him again in a while to eat. He must walk again before the sun sets. I will watch him through the night.
Derwin turned away from the bed and slowly shook his head back and forth.
How could I have let him slip so far?
In truth, it is not your blame. You have done all that could be asked. And even now, you have saved his life.
Alenia patted Derwin's arm gently and smiled with calm assurance.
The god has opened my eyes in time, my lady. That is something indeed to be thankful for. But we must not slacken our vigil again, or he will be lost. He is very weak, and his strength very fragile.
Come to the kitchen, Derwin, and refresh yourself. You too will be needing your strength in the hours to come, as will we all.
Quentin twisted on the ground. A sharp pain seared through his side. One eye was swelling shut, and his mouth, tasting of blood, throbbed with a dull ache. He raised his head slowly and looked cautiously about. Smoke from the burning town still drifted in hanging clouds, which rolled along the ground, stinging his eyes and making his nose run. The sun was barely up, a fierce red ball burning through the black haze which filled the air and seeped down the slopes of the ravine where he lay. A soldier nearby saw Quentin's slight movement and jabbed him in the shoulder with the butt of his lance. Quentin put his head down again and lay still. He had seen what he wanted to see. The main force of soldiers had moved off. Only a few remained to guard the prisoners, if prisoners there were, for Tolly was nowhere to be seen. Quentin tried to wiggle his fingers, but they were numb. The ropes which bound him had been tied tightly and efficiently. Both hands were thrust behind his back and lashed together. A loop passed around his neck and one around his feet. To move hands or feet tightened the noose around his neck and strangled him. But periodically, Quentin wormed this way and that in an attempt to better reckon his surroundings. It was only by the hand of the god that he was still alive. In the chaotic moment of his capture, he had been instantly beaten senseless. As he lay bleeding on the ground, a scowling warrior had raised a double-bladed axe over him. Quentin had seen the blade flash on its downward arc toward his heart. He was saved at the last heartbeat by a hand which caught the axeman's arm in mid-stroke. An argument had broken out then. Although Quentin could not understand the slurred words of the rough speech, he knew that it concerned him and his probable fate. The soldier with the axe wanted to kill him at once. The other apparently insisted upon waiting, probably for a superior's approval. Quentin was then bound up and left to wonder what awaited him. He did not have long to wait. There was a sudden scurrying around him, and he was jerked urgently upward to his knees by two grim warriors grasping him by the arms. Quentin's head was snapped sharply back by a hand thrust into his hair. His eyes squeezed shut with the pain. When he opened them again, he was looking into the cold, hardened eyes of a warlord of Nin. The warlord regarded him coolly. He was wearing a strange form of battle dress made of bronze, which glowed in the rising sun with a reddened luster that matched the tint of his flesh. His arms were covered in sleeves of mail from his shoulders to his wide, heavy hands, and from knee to ankle he wore bronze leggings. He wore no helmet, and his long black hair was pulled back and bound in a long thick braid which hung down his back. A long curved sword hung from the pommel of the saddle, its thin blade besmeared with crimson ribbons of blood. The warlord's horse, wide of shoulder and heavy of flank, shook its braided mane. Quentin guessed that the soldier was telling his commander about how the prisoner had been captured. The warlord listened intently. Quentin then thought he saw a spark of interest light the savage countenance.
Mevkin.
Two soldiers rushed forward and untied his legs. Then Quentin was hauled to his feet and marched away. The warlord watched him go, then spurred his horse and rode off down the ravine. Quentin was pulled up the steep bank of the dry stream bed. In the smoke blowing across the field, clustered around several great wagons, he saw soldiers, all wearing the same coarse dark clothing and carrying brutal-looking double-bladed battle axes. At one of the wagons, the soldiers gave up their weapons, which were collected and placed in the wagon. At another, they were given large baskets. They then hurried back into the smoldering remains of Ulam. Quentin was taken to one of the nearer wagons and placed up against one of the huge wheels, so large that it was fully as tall as he was. He was untied and then lashed to the wheel by his wrists and ankles. He had no choice but to watch the strange activity taking place in the ruins. A line of soldiers emerged from the curtain of smoke, carrying sacks of grain and casks of wine. These and other foodstuffs, the provisions of the entire town, were heaped up into a great pile and then loaded into hand-drawn barrows which carted the provisions away. Then soldiers with baskets began filing past two by two, moving off into the hills. Quentin could not see where they were going, but knew the general direction to be north. The men carried the baskets on their shoulders, some bent low by the weight of what they carried. Quentin wondered what the baskets contained. But as he watched the activity around him, his mind returned again and again to the one thing he feared most. More than his own safety, he wondered what had become of Toli. His friend, companion, and servant was gone. There were two possible explanations, he knew. Either Toli had been killed in the attack, in which case his body lay unattended back down in the ravine, or the crafty Jared managed to somehow escape in the confusion of the battle. Quentin prayed that Toli had escaped. A rank of men on horses moved past the wagons. Each carried an axe and a shield, as well as the peculiar curved sword. The horses, too, were armored. Large discs of hardened leather, attached with rings of iron and woven into strips, were slung over the animal's withers and rump, trailing almost to the ground. Upon their hooves were bands of sharpened spikes, and two long, cruel spikes sprouted from each horse's headplate as well. Whoever they were, they had come prepared for war. To Quentin's horror, the wagons began rolling. Quentin thought that they had forgotten about him.
Stop! Stop the wagon! I'm still here! Stop the wagon! Yes.
Quentin knew by their laughter that they had not forgotten him. He was intended to travel with them in this torturous manner, battered slowly to death on the turning wheel. Yesef sat on a bench in his courtyard, his head nodding on his breast. All around him, the gentle sounds of evening crept into the air. The sun had slipped behind the hills of Dekra, and though the sky was still a brilliant blue, streaked with orange clouds, long evening shadows cast the clean-swept courtyard of the esteemed elder into deep gloaming. A young laurel tree rattled its fragrant leaves in the fitful breeze. His cup sat untasted near his hand. When he looked up, Carol, his wife, was beside him. Yesef could feel the warmth of her presence as she stood looking down on him.
My husband is tired from his day's work. Dear one, awaken! Our evening meal is ready.
Yesef raised his head, and she saw his eyes gradually take in his surroundings as awareness returned. She saw the deeply etched lines of concern furrow his brow and crinkle around his eyes. He smiled when he saw her, and she noticed that it was a sad smile with no light in it.
Husband, what is wrong?
I have had a dream.
And your dream has troubled you, for it was a dream of darkness instead of light.
How much you women see. Yes, it was a dream of darkness, a vision. I saw... No, I must not tell you what I have seen just yet. I must ponder it in my heart for a time.
Then you may eat while you ponder. Come, your supper will be getting cold.
Carol turned and padded back into their dwelling. Yesef watched her go, thinking how lucky he had been to find one so wise and understanding to share his old age. He raised himself slowly and followed her in. As they lingered over their meal, Carol watched her mate closely. He did not eat with his usual fresh appetite, but dawdled over his plate. In the lambent glow of the candles on the low table, Yesef sank further into pensive reflection. Twice he brought a morsel of food to his mouth, only to return it to the plate absently.
Yesef, you have not eaten well tonight. Your dream has upset you. If you will not tell me, perhaps you will tell the elders instead.
Yes, that is what I must do.
Yesef got up from his stool at once and went to the door, where he paused and turned toward her, his form a dark silhouette against the evening sky. He seemed suddenly to come to himself once more.
I am going to call together the other elders. We will meet tonight. Do not wait for me, my love. May be very late.
I do not mind. I have some work with which to occupy myself while you are gone. Now away with you. The quicker you go, the quicker I will have my Yesif back.
In an inner chamber of the great Araga Temple, Yesif waited for the elders to join him. It would not be long, for he had sent runners, three of the young men who served in the temple, to fetch the other Kuratak leaders. He had merely to wait for their arrival, and the meeting could begin. Yesif busied himself with lighting the many candles which stood on their long holders around the bare room. In the center of the room, four straight high-backed chairs sat in a circle facing each other. When the candles had been lit, Yesif took his place, folding his hands in his lap in quiet meditation. In a few moments, the curtains which overhung the chamber's entrance parted, and the familiar form of Jolin entered, smoothing his council robes.
Good evening, Elder Yesif. Your summons saved me from quite a distasteful chore. I had promised to begin translating a song for some of the children.
That distasteful? Surely you do not mean it. If you do, perhaps it were better you went back and got right to work.
Oh, no, do not misunderstand. I love the children and would give them anything. But the song they have chosen is of the old Araga dialect. A very dreary piece about an unhappy youngster who is changed into a willow because of his complaining. I tried to persuade them to choose something happier, but their hearts were set on this one and none other.
Ha! You will be the better for it in the end, I am sure. An excursion into the old dialect will sharpen your wits.
If I did not know better, I would suspect you of having put them up to it. It would be just like you.
The next to enter was Pater, the unofficial leader of the group. It was he who most often took it upon himself to inform the Kuratak of the elders' decisions in matters of public import. He was a most able and influential orator, and often led the worship in the temple. He was well studied in the religion of the vanished Araga.
Greetings, my learned friends.
Pater's eyes gleamed in anticipation of the evening's work. For whatever it was, it would involve him in close communion with other sharp minds, a thing he dearly loved.
Greetings, Potter. Thank you for coming along so quickly. We have only to await... here he comes now.
Yesif nodded to the curtain, and Clamor, the most recent addition to the group upon the death of Asaph, the oldest member, entered, bowing low.
Good evening, brothers. I pray you are well.
The others nodded, and they all took their places. Yesif looked from one to the other of their familiar faces. These were his most trusted friends. Yes, Clamor was right. His brothers. He could tell them his dream, and they would shoulder its burden, no matter how small or great it would prove in the end. He felt better just being in their presence, and wondered if any of them ever felt the same way about him. He supposed they did, as often as they had sought his counsel, singly or with the others. Now it was his turn to put a problem before them.
Good, Yesif, do not keep us in suspense any longer. Tell us what disturbs you, for I see in your eyes that your spirit is distressed by something.
You speak all right. I am troubled.
Yesif paused as he collected his thoughts and looked at each of them in turn.
This evening I had a dream. Very brief it was, and very strange.
You believe it to presage something of significance?
I do.
And have you an interpretation for us?
No. That is why I've asked you to come here tonight. I thought perhaps together we might seek understanding.
Very well. Tell us your dream as it came to you. We will ask the Most High to enlighten us with its meaning.
I had just stepped into the courtyard when a great drowsiness came over me, even though I had not eaten. I quickly fell asleep where I sat and began to dream. And the dream was this. I saw a river running through the land. And wherever the river touched the land, it sprang forth abundantly with green shoots and trees and food for all living things. And the water was clear and good. Men came to the river's edge to drink, and the wild creatures drank and were satisfied. But then a dark storm came out of the east and began to blow. The river still ran, but the water began to change, becoming the color of blood. At first, just a trace of red clouded the clean water. But it deepened until the water ran black and the river became foul. Now, no one could drink from the river and live. Men who drank of it died, and animals too.
and all the trees and grass and flowers which had sprung up along the river's banks now withered and died. The land became desolate, for all things depended upon the river for their life. The winds came and blew away the dust, and dust filled the air in great clouds covering the land, and the river dried up. Darkness fell upon the land, and I heard a voice crying out. It was the voice of a terrified child saying,
"Where is my father? I am afraid! Where is my protector?"
The darkness rolled up in answer to the child.
"Your father's bones are dust and scattered to the winds. Your protector's sword is broken. You will live in darkness all your days. For now, you are a child of the night."
I wept to hear those words. My tears fell like a mighty rain upon the earth, and the rain of tears washed over the land, which had become a bowl to catch the tears and hold them all.
"Where are my servants? What has become of those whom I call upon?"
I answered a new, stronger voice, saying,
"I am here, and only I. All others have perished."
I fell on my face in my grief.
"Rise up and take the bowl and pour it out."
I took the bowl in my hands and poured it out, and it became a sword of living light which flashed in the face of the darkness. And the darkness fled before it.
"Take the sword."
I began to tremble all over because I knew I could not take up the sword. "I have never touched a sword and do not know how to use it."
"Then give it to the child. He will use it, and you will guide his hand."
But when I looked for the child to give him the shining sword, he was gone.
"No, please! Help me! Help me, please!"
The night had swallowed him up, and the darkness carried him further and further away.
Yosef opened his eyes once more and looked at his brothers in their council robes. They sat unmoving as they pondered his words. Their eyes were grave, and their faces reflected the concern they all felt at hearing Yosef's dream.
"Brothers, this is a most unsettling dream. I hear in it a warning of some urgency. Let us now ask the Most High to guide us in our interpretation, for I believe it has given us this night to oppose the powers of darkness bespoken in the dream."
At that, the elders of Dekra joined hands and began to pray. The sleek black stallion seemed to flow down hills and through valleys like water. Esme had only to press with her knees or move a hand to the right or left, and the horse responded, as if to her very thoughts. The animal was remarkably well trained, so much so that Esme began to fear for its welfare. Riv would run until his heart burst, before slackening his pace in disobedience to his rider's command. The scene of the ill-fated fight lay far behind her now, and still the horse flew on, the lather streaming off his neck and shoulders in flecks whipped away by the wind. Esme saw the dark line of a creek snaking through the lowland valley ahead. Where the creek rounded the grassy base of a hill, there rose a stand of young birches, shimmering white in the morning light. That would be a good place to rest.
"Whoa, Riv!"
The birches ringed a shady hollow where long grasses grew, fed by the stream. It was secluded and invisible to any who might come after her. The stony feet of the hill lay exposed at one side of the hollow, where the stream formed a shallow pool. Esme slid from the saddle and led Riv into the shady grove, walking him slowly. The hollow was cool and silent, and full of golden spatters of sunlight and green shadow. Warily, she advanced toward the running water. Esme led her mount to the edge of the pool and watched as he plunged his nose into the water. Esme knelt in the long grass, cupped her hands, and brought the clear water to her mouth. When she had finished, she led Riv to a patch of wild clover and let him eat his fill. She didn't bother to tether him, knowing that a horse as well-trained as Riv would not abandon his rider to wander off. She left the horse to crop the clover and turned her attention to the hill nearby. It presented to her the highest vantage for viewing her surroundings. Having left the fray at the ravine with little more thought than to come away with her skin, She had almost no idea where she might be. As much as possible, she had tried to hold to the direction whereby they had entered the ravine in the first place, her object being to regain the road they had been following. Once on the road, she would turn north and then hurry to Ascalon. Esme climbed the steep slope of the hill as it rose out of the vale and above the trees. Out of the shade, the air was warmer and alive with bees and butterflies beginning their daily chores. A fresh wind blew ruffles along the tall grass. The sky billowed bright and blue, unconcerned with the darker deeds of night and desperate men. Here, she could almost forget what had passed just a few hours earlier. But she could not forget the two gallant men who had so courageously flown to the aid of the helpless townspeople, and who had, without question, offered her protection as well. She turned her eyes back toward Yulum, now leagues behind her. There was nothing to be seen. Not even a smudge of smoke on the horizon remained to mark the place. For a moment, she stood in indecision. Should she return and try to discover what had become of her friends? Or go on to complete her charge and deliver her message to the king? It was an empty choice. The enemy which had overcome them in the ravine at Yulum was the same which had surprised her and her companions on the road. Now the lives of two more had been added to the sum, for there was little doubt in her mind that by now Quentin and Tully were dead. And were it not for the importance of her mission, she would have stayed to share their fate. There was nothing to be done but to go on. She gazed out over the land, her dark eyes sweeping the horizon for any recognizable landmark. Away to the south, she saw a thin slice of spangled blue which merged with the sky.
The sea. I have not gone far wrong.
By squinting up her eyes, she could almost see the road itself as it hugged the coastal hills. She cast one last look over her shoulder to see if the dark enemy had followed her, but saw nothing except the radiant sky and the hills of summer. So she turned with heavy heart to leave and clambered back down the side of the hill. Was the whinny from Riv or some other? She stopped, her heart now fluttering in panic. She listened. In the tangle of leaves and branches, she could not see the animal, nor its assailant. As quickly and as quietly as she could, she slipped the rest of the way down the hill, careful not to show herself openly. Once below the treetop, she saw Riv, legs splayed, head down, backed against the rocks, shaking his mane and baring his teeth. But she could see nothing at all that should so upset him. All was as she had left it. Not a single intruder, man or beast, was in evidence. Esme dropped to the ground and crouched in the grass for a moment. Hearing nothing and seeing nothing disturbing, she rose and went to the frightened animal to comfort it.
There, easy boy.
She patted his sleek jaw and curled a slim arm around his neck.
Easy now. What is it, huh? What has affrighted my brave one?
But the horse continued to look away across the creek, and nothing Esme could see.
There now. See, all is well. There is nothing.
Riv tossed his head and broke away from her.
But
the horse leapt away and ran through the long grass to stand across the hollow.
Riv, you perverse creature! Come back here!
Esme stood with her hands on her hips as the horse bucked and shied, spinning in circles of fear as she watched.
It has gotten into that animal!
Esme had seen nothing like it before.
Away, foul beast! And take your rider, or be ye still and stand beside her.
At the strange words, Esme whirled around. Her hand flew to the long dagger at her belt.
Not hangman's knot, nor blade of knife prevail against this sibyl's life.
Esme couldn't believe her eyes. For there, in a huddle of rags on a rock in the middle of the creek, stood a humpbacked old woman. She held a long staff in one hand and waved the other before her as if warding off bees. As Esme watched in mute astonishment, the old woman hopped lightly as a cricket from stone to stone. Upon landing on the bank, the old woman shook her rags in a flurry. Then she proceeded to hobble toward the spot where Esme stood, gaping in amazement. Where had she come from?
Who are you, old mother?
The withered creature did not answer, but drew closer in her peculiar hopping gait, swinging the staff and puffing mightily. Her hair hung in a mass of tangled gray snakes bedecked with bits of leaf and twig. The shriveled face looked like a dried apple, a mass of lines and creases browned by the wind and baked by the sun. When the woman moved, Esme imagined she could hear her brittle bones rattle. She appeared as old as the rocks under the hill.
Who are you?
The hag made a pass in front of her with her wavering paw. Esme saw the rough hands and blackened nails, and noticed, too, the scent of smoke and filth which billowed about the old woman.
If rock and hill and laughing water be hearth and home, I'm Orphe's daughter.
The hag turned her weathered face slyly toward Esme and grinned, a leering, toothless grin. It was then that Esme saw the sunken sockets where once eyes used to be. The old woman was utterly blind.
You live here, in this hollow?
So ye say, and speak ye true. And I would ask the same of you.
Me? I am Esme. I did not mean to disturb your home. I heard the horse.
Esme turned and noticed that Riv had calmed and now stood watching and cautiously nodding his head, as if spellbound.
I will trouble you no further, but will leave at once.
Of leaving, let no more be spoken, till I have known you by your token.
The ancient oracle held out her hand and propped her chin on her staff and waited. She looked like a bent and gnarled tree on a withered stump, offering a lonely branch.
I do not have a token, old mother.
It did not do to upset an oracle, especially one of the caste who called themselves the Daughters of Orphe, for they were very powerful and wise.
But let me offer a blessing in your name when next I come to a shrine.
Of blessings I have little need. Bless me instead with a noble deed.
Esme started at the old woman's use of the word noble.
What deed would you have me perform?
The rabbit caught within yon fryer tastes the better when a roast with fire.
The old woman crooked a knobby finger along the stream behind them. Esme followed it with her eyes and saw a hawthorn thicket rustling vigorously as if something were indeed caught within it.
You would have me cook you a meal? This is the deed you require? Very well.
Esme went reluctantly to retrieve the rabbit she knew she would find caught among the thorns. Esme had no difficulty catching the rabbit. She could see it struggling in the thicket. Reaching in carefully, she pulled it out by the scruff of the neck. She could feel its tiny heart beating madly as she held it close. It gave a terrified kick and leapt out of her arms. She watched as it bounded away. Afraid that she had lost it, it would now be cursed by the oracle for failing in her deed. But the rabbit, a plump hare, gave two faltering jumps and then pitched forward dead. Esme ran to it and picked it up. The racing heart was still. She took her dagger and cut off its head to bleed it. She left it dangling by its hind legs from a branch while she went in search of wood to make a fire. When at last the fire was crackling and the skinned rabbit gutted and roasting on a spit, Esme went to the seeress.
Your meal will be ready soon, old mother, and I have found you an apple to eat with your meat.
The apple she had thoughtfully peeled and diced into a wooden bowl, which she retrieved from Toli's pack behind the saddle. She then ground the large golden globe to mash with the handle of her dagger. The hag said nothing, but hopped nearer the fire and seated herself. Esme went to the stream and filled a second bowl with water.
Perhaps Orphe's daughter would care to wash her hands before eating.
Esme held the bowl before her. The old woman nodded regally and dipped her hands daintily into the bowl and rubbed them together. The water turned murky with dirt. The old woman then wiped her wet hands on her filthy clothes and smiled. Esme fetched her another bowl of water, took the cooked meat from the spit, and cut it into strips which she shredded and chopped.
Your meal, m'lady.
Esme withdrew to watch the old woman dine with obvious pleasure, licking her fingers. When she had finished, she held out the bowl for more. Esme filled it again and sat down beside her to wait. The sun reached its zenith, dwindling the shadows in the glade to nothing, and still the old woman hunkered over her bowl. Esme clasped her hands around her knees and forced herself to wait as patiently as possible. At last, the old woman had eaten her fill. She placed the bowls on the ground beside her and rose up. She shook herself forward to stand before Esme and leaned once more on her staff. This she did with such surety of motion and without hesitation that Esme realized for the first time that the hag saw as much with her inner eye as others did with perfect vision. She shuddered to think that as a child, the woman had probably had her eyes put out to further enhance her strange gift.
The deed was done, and with thoughtful art, as best befits a most noble heart. By this I know, as by gold rings, princess ye are, and your father king.
Esme jumped to her feet. The hag had spoken rightly, but it frightened her to have her secret so easily known.
You see much that cannot be seen with eyes alone, priestess. Since I have served you as you asked, allow me to leave with your blessing.
A blessing, ye ask? And this ye receive. Your secret safe, if none you deceive. Full rare is she, whose safety would spend in risking death for love of a friend. But this ye do, and this will be found. Your errand done, when two are unbound.
The old woman turned and scuttled away. Esme felt a nudge at her elbow and realized that Riv had come to her and was anxious to be off and away from the queer old woman. Esme climbed into the saddle and watched the shapeless bundle of rags hop from stone to stone back across the stream.
Thank you for your blessing, daughter of Orphe. May your prophecy be true.
At that, the hag stopped and turned once more toward Esme. She raised her crooked staff overhead with both hands and turned around three times, very fast. Esme wondered that she did not fall off her precarious perch in the middle of the stream.
I speak what is, and not what may be. But since you ask, hear my prophecy.
Her hand shot into the air, fingers spread like a claw.
Seek ye the sword, and do not yield it. If to be slayed, a king must wield it.
With a skip and a jump, the hag disappeared as quickly and as mysteriously as she had come. But long after she was gone, her words rang in Esme's ears like the clear peal of a bell.